this is the Better Business. It's my name is Dom Knight. Hello, Andrew Hay Straits.
Hello, Dom Knight. How are you?
I'm very well. Now, Andrew, do you remember last year we launched your book at Better Ed Than Dead in Newtown? Great night, really fun. But on that same night, just as we were celebrating your writing and creativity, your home state of South Australia was having a massive power crisis. Lights were off across the state, lifts stopped. It was essentially chaos without power. And in the aftermath of that, there's been a huge debate about renewables and their impact on power and the grid nationally. The Finkel Review's taken place, and the Coalition have once again launched themselves into a climate debate that's threatening Malcolm Turnbull's leadership. Tony Abbott's fully out of his box now, and power of a different kind is up for grabs in Canberra. So it's a perfect day to talk renewables, and we have an old friend of yours on the line, Peter Owen of the South Australian Wilderness Society. Hello, Peter.
How you going, Dom?
You're really well.
Just going to say, totally is an old friend. I'm going to boast. We were in rock bands at the same time.
What, rock bands?
Yeah.
Like with guitars and stuff.
Totes. For the, like, probably three people who are listening to this who were going out and seeing bands in the early 90s, in the mid-90s in Adelaide. Pete was in Reckoning. I was in The Undecided. The world was our oyster, Dom. I cannot tell you how much the world was our oyster. And look at us now! Well, actually, Pete's kind of gotten very impressive and is genuinely doing good things, whereas I'm just, I don't know, I don't know what it is that I do. But nonetheless, Pete, it's such a pleasure to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
Now, I suppose it would have been pretty bad to be in a band in Adelaide on that night. It would have been strictly unplugged territory across the city. How was it for you? Where were you? Were you in town? Were you at home or something?
Yeah, no, I was in the Wilderness Society office, right in the centre of the CBD of Adelaide, and I can remember all the power going out, and I couldn't get down to the street because the lifts weren't working. I had to go down the emergency stairs and walk down onto the street, and it was just torrential rain and people in chaos and panic everywhere, because obviously nothing was working, the lights, the traffic crossings, everything, and it's amazing how quickly it all unfolds in that situation.
I'm absolutely disappointed that it didn't devolve into Thunderdome, frankly. I figure if Thunderdome's going to hit anywhere, it'll start in Adelaide and then spread outwards.
Well, to be honest, it felt a bit like that. It took me hours to get home. The buses fell into chaos. It doesn't take much.
Mm. And, of course, as we know, it was all because we didn't have enough coal-burning power plants. So that's the entire reason for it. And anybody who says otherwise is basically a communist. I mean, that's certainly my understanding.
Yeah, well, we've had a very odd situation take hold since that night. No one seems to remember the fact that the climate's changing fairly quickly. And one of the reasons the power went down is because some incredibly strong winds ripped through the north of the state, taking out power pylons everywhere. And if we want more and more of those types of storms, probably keep burning fossil fuels, coal, gas, and oil. So it's a very odd situation that's taken hold since that night.
Yeah, it's a weird catch-22, isn't it, where they're kind of going, because of the grid being out, we need more coal. But then the coal was out in part because of the winds, because of the extreme weather that climate change brings. So as is often the case, both sides of the debate, to the extent that it even is a debate, given that the Antarctic is melting, are seeing what they want to see in the argument, aren't they? I mean, if from supporters of fossil fuels and some of our friends at The Australian, the incident was proof that renewables don't work, that we need dear old coal and indeed more of it.
Oh, look, if they're going to look seriously at what happened that night, the severity of those winds was unprecedented. It took out huge power pylons. The power went out. If we want to continue going down the path that we are with regard to burning fossil fuels, we're going to see obviously more and more weather scenarios like that, which means more and more power blackouts. The only solution is to get serious about renewable energy, and the continued burning of fossil fuels really needs to be phased out rapidly.
Either that or we just have to get really, really strong pylons. That's the other.
Well, it's kind of hard to imagine how, even a whole bunch of supposedly clean coal power stations would be able to survive the pylons falling down. So, look, one solution would be renewables. The other, I guess, would be to start burning coal in the home again, like in the good old days where everyone had a little coke stove out the back. Unless you want to breathe, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I mean, all these things are options. It really just depends on what kind of future we want to have. And like I said before, you know, the continued expansion of the fossil fuel industry, and in fact, you know, a slow transition out of the fossil fuel industry when we actually need a rapid one, is locking in a climate scenario that's pretty bleak for the second half of all of our lives, but certainly for our kids' lives. So I would have thought responsible governance required decisions that can only head us in the direction of a very fast transition to renewable energy.
Well, I mean, that's also because you're talking about a future. Well, I'm assuming that the future that you're talking about is not the one that is necessarily being looked at by a fair slab of the coalition at this point, by the looks of things, which is a future with Tony Abbott as PM. Because this seems to be this has gone very, very rapidly in the last, you know, literally in the last sort of day and a half, from an argument about a pretty weak target and a pretty lame strategy, which, you know, even Labour, who do not have exactly the strongest environmental credentials on this matter, even they're saying that, you know, we'll support this, but only because anything sensible appears to be off the table. But even that's now looking under threat, as is the leadership of Malcolm Turnbull, which is, it's like 2009 all over again.
Yeah, and let's not underestimate the power of the fossil fuel lobby. You know, they are very influential within the Liberal Party and the Labor Party, which is why we're having these absurd discussions. Let's also not underestimate the fact that the discussions that we're having in Australia are quite surreal in comparison to the discussions around climate change that are happening in many other parts of the world, because Australia is one of the biggest exporters of fossil fuels on the planet. So we will be in denial until there can be no denying happening anymore. So there's little doubt that discussions here, in terms of a lot of the more progressive parts of the planet, they're looking at Australia and thinking, wow, you know, what in the world is going on there? So we're living in under a fairly surreal reality at the moment, unfortunately.
Well, it depends as well. Like, from what I understand, Tony Abbott didn't actually read the Finkel Review before convening a meeting fairly rapidly to try and discuss it and pull out of the idea of a clean energy target. He doesn't need to read it to know that it's bad.
Exactly. It's Ian MacDonald and the Forgotten Children report all over again. This is like Liberal Party nostalgia. It's just so many
some of the classic
hitting
hits
so many of the old classics
are coming out. But yeah, we are living in an era when Donald Trump, who I'm just going to go out on a limb, I suspect he doesn't know a whole lot about energy policy, but he's pulled out of the Paris Agreement, of course, as well. Although it seems as though many US cities are just going to jump in and fill that breach. At the same time, we see China and India being incredibly gung-ho about renewables, and China in particular wanting to lead the world in this sense, Peter. How is that side of things coming along? I mean, as much as we discuss this stuff and debate it endlessly, a lot of other countries are pushing boldly forward, are they not?
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening. I mean, it makes business sense to be rapidly moving into renewable technologies. There's no doubt that's the future. And there's also no doubt that continuing to invest in coal infrastructure can only mean stranded assets if we're serious about, you know, addressing the issue that we have. And that is that unless we stop burning fossil fuels, the livability of the climate into the future is bleak. So, you know, it's pretty simple. We don't have an option to continue on the fossil fuel path. We have to move to renewables rapidly. It makes business sense. It makes economic sense. Renewables are fast becoming, you know, a much cheaper energy source than the old fossil fuels. So I'd suggest that, you know, countries like China and India are just making sensible decisions.
Well, it's weird that China have been so forward on, particularly on solar, given that it's my understanding that they invented climate change as a way of damaging the American economy. I mean, that's what no less an authority than Donald Trump has told us.
in a tweet, which is now an official policy of the US government. So,
that's the only way they do policies now. They don't do legislation.
History is going to paint a lot of those comments in a, you know, in a very depressing way. In some ways, I mean, the Earth was also flat once upon a time. You know, we've moved on. We need responsible governance, and we need it rapidly, because what's coming down the line here in terms of climate change ain't pretty.
So what would a sensible climate policy look like right now? If I mean, assuming that something shiny happened and Abbott and most of the Liberal backbench were distracted enough for Turnbull to put through a serious climate strategy, what would that look like? What would you like that to look like?
I mean, we need to be transitioning toward, you know, 100% renewable energy as quickly as we can possibly get there. You know, we should be investing in renewable energy fast, and a genuine investment in renewables will create a lot of jobs. So that will deal with some of the argument around this. There's all these jobs in maintaining the status quo, and we can't rock that boat. Well, actually, the world's moving rapidly. There are many, many, many people being employed in these rapidly emerging renewable energy technology sectors in other parts of the world. Why would it be any different here?
You say that, but you know, like you look at the way that we managed to stop the automobile industry because it was going to lose all those jobs in wagon wheels. You know, there was a whole wagon wheel industry, an Ostling. Well, think of the Ostlers.
Fortunately, they redirected their efforts to chocolate, and chocolate wagon wheels continue to this very day.
They do, and they're quite tasty.
Pete, in terms of renewables, so I know there are a lot of people who believe that zero emission power is possible, that the technology is already there. I've talked to some of them previously, but I'm keen to know, in terms of where we are, what does a zero energy situation look like in Australia? What's the mix of renewables? How much work is it to try and make it happen? I mean, I know that technically it's possible if political will was there, and South Australia is quite a long way down this path relative to the rest of the country. What are we going to build?
It'll be a combination of wind, predominantly wind and solar, and we've certainly got a hell of a lot of sun in this country, and we've got a hell of a lot of wind. And there's numerous other opportunities in the renewables field. But you know, we have to believe that we can do this, and we can. We have no option. Like if war is suddenly declared, we don't sit around twiddling our thumbs for 35 years whilst we, you know, carry out a slow transition in defending wherever the war is, you know, broken out. Well, you know, that's the kind of scale of mobilisation that is required, because, you know, it's hard to even express the magnitude of the climate change that is at stake is very, very serious. And we keep hearing all of these elected officials talking about, yes, we believe that climate change is serious, but we're playing the long game. Well, we don't have a long game here. You know, we have a very small window of opportunity in which to act and make some fundamental changes. And it's not just about renewable. I mean, renewable energy, 100% renewable energy in this country should be a no-brainer. That should be a given. But the vast majority of our country's fossil fuel footprint is the ginormous fossil fuel exports that we currently have going out of this country, and the push by governments to expand that fossil fuel export industry. You know, right now we're talking about a push to expand the fossil fuel industry into the Great Australian Bight, a push to expand the coal industry with Adani and things in Queensland. You know, this is probably one of the biggest onshore and biggest offshore fossil fuel pushes in the planet, on the entire planet right now. So, you know, that really is also the big issue. The renewables debate, I think, is an important one, and it should be a no-brainer. We should transition to 100% renewables rapidly. But we've got to address the export industry of fossil fuels out of this country, which, as I said before, is almost the biggest in the world. And we've got to stop the expansion of that industry, I would have thought, immediately, and we've got to fairly quickly transition out of it, because that is not the future. The future cannot be the export of fossil fuels unless we are going to have, as I've said numerous times now, a very bleak future in terms of a climate that's verging on being unlivable.
And I think for a lot of people, you know, they're very acutely aware of what's happening in the Great Barrier Reef.
and perhaps to some extent what's happening on the sort of in some of the mountain areas. But where are things at in the Bight, both in terms of well, particularly in terms of whether or not, because am I right in thinking it's BP who have been trying to drill there?
Well, BP actually withdrew from the Great Australian Bight late last year. But there are numerous other companies with lease arrangements in the Bight. One Chevron, one is a company called Statoil, which just last week announced that it was taking over two of BP's old leases. You know, pushing to expand the oil industry at this point in history, you know, as we've said, is simply not an option. You know, recent reports late last year essentially said that to have any chance of staying below a 2 degree global warming limit, more than 50% of the oil that's already on the books of these oil majors from this part of the world can't be burnt. So, you know, the question is, what on earth are we doing looking for more? You know, whilst putting at risk the pristine, you know, marine environment of the Great Australian Bight Whale Nursery. Let's remember, this is one of the most significant whale nurseries on the planet, but also the oil spill modelling that BP released just before they pulled the plug out here late last year showed that if something goes wrong, it's basically catastrophic. There is nothing they can do about it. The Bight's very deep, it's very rough, it's very remote, it's a completely different situation to the Gulf of Mexico 5 years ago, which still wiped out that entire area, but there was a lot of infrastructure to deal with something going wrong there. The Bight is a crazy proposition and needs to be stopped immediately.
Yeah, because in Gulf of Mexico, am I right in thinking that there was a that they had a plug for the leak fit, like geographically quite close, whereas if and that was still, you know, an absolute disaster. Whereas in the Bight, it would take somewhere between weeks and months to get something out, because I think the nearest one is in South America or something ridiculous. Like
well, Singapore. There was numerous proposals put forward, but yeah, that was what was being put forward last year, which is crazy. I mean, we would argue that, like I said, you can't afford to be pushing to expand this industry at this point in history. We need to be transitioning out of it, and there's so much oil already on the books of these companies that, you know, we can't burn the vast majority of it if we're going to have a livable climate into the future. But secondly, you know, the risks associated with this type of deep sea drilling in a place as remote and rough as the Bight is extremely high. And that part of the world's a pristine marine environment, and it sustains probably one of the biggest fishing fleets in the country, if not this part of the world. It also sustains a huge tourism industry. You know, combined, they employ tens of thousands of people and contribute probably somewhere between $1 and $2 billion to the Southern Australian economy. You know, we're putting all of this at risk. These are real jobs. This is a real economy for, you know, some multinational company that, you know, we really don't know quite what they might do in the event of a disaster out here. So it makes no sense.
So, Peter, look, the of course, climate science is far from in debate. It hasn't been for years. The arguments in favour of renewables seem compelling as well, particularly in the sense that it's happening, and if we choose not to go down that path now, we're going to be outcompeted by those who do. What I'm interested in is, given those things, how do you build political will? Because it seems strange that we're still having the same debates years on, to the point where a lot of people sort of switch off when they hear climate mentioned, even though we are talking about it impending doom in a fairly fairly real and horrifying sense. And it does affect us, you know, in an ongoing basis in terms of things like extreme weather, as we're beginning to see. How do you, as an activist, campaign around this? How do you generate enthusiasm and push for social change? And what's the strategy to try and defeat the entrenched elements that are still making this so so difficult?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, people power is the only solution. And as more and more people start to realise that actually our governments no longer appear to be representing us, they appear to be representing the interests of multinational companies. Things like that. And I think it's a matter of getting those messages out there. This is not in our interests. So why are our elected officials doing this? You know, and a spotlight needs to be right on this. And I mean, this is really the big discussion, I think, you know, moving forward. As I said before, Australia is is out of step with much of the rest of the world on the discussion around how we're going to deal and change and adapt to climate. We are in total denial here. And a big part of that is because we're one of the biggest exporters of fossil fuels. And so we will be literally, you know, in that last group of countries to do anything. And unfortunately, that the boat will have long sailed, and Australia is going to end up, I think, doing itself very serious economic damage if the influence of the fossil fuel in Canberra, but also in all of the state governments, is allowed to continue. Because this is not the future; it simply can't be.
God, that's depressing.
So that said, I mean, what's the strategy to go and try and get heard? Because we've seen in recent years the Greens have been less of a force than they were. Certainly Kevin Rudd's Labor came into office promising to be real about climate change. Malcolm Turnbull was on board with that, the point where he essentially agreed with their CPRS at one stage. And we know he's something of a technocrat and probably his heart still is in this, even though that's no longer his consideration. I mean, you say people power, but how does that translate into actual, like, are we talking about demonstrations? Do we need to try and do it in the ballot box? What's the strategy to turn this around?
Yeah, look, I think it's all of the above. I think you're starting to see, the rise of numerous new political forces. You do have to question whether the Coalition and the ALP are, spent forces. Politically, they seem to have their wagons hitched to the past, both of those parties, and they seem unable to address that problem. Seeing the rapid emergence of a lot of independents and new political parties into the arena over the next 10 years, I would have thought needs to be encouraged. The population, the Australian population, can't keep voting for political parties that are putting forward, ideas that really belong 50 years in the past. The stakes are too high now. And I mean, ultimately, the only way this is going to change is if, people get off the couch and get involved. Democracy doesn't function unless we engage. And that's not engaging, once every 3 or 4 years at the ballot box. I mean, that's not democracy if that's the only engagement you have with it. We've got to actually get off the couch and activate community groups and start talking to each other again and actually decide what type of future we want. And we've got to move in that direction quickly. So these types of discussions need to be encouraged and they need to be happening all over the country.
So in a weird way, probably people like Trump and Abbott are doing more for getting people involved in climate activism than Rudd and Turnbull back when they were supporting things.
Yeah, I mean, I think you may be right there, Andrew. I mean, Trump's position and Abbott's position on these issues are so off the planet that it should be a major shock to the system that something is wrong here. Something is terribly wrong, and the current situation must change, and it's now or never, really. I know we're feeling pretty comfortable in our houses. We're sitting back on the couches watching the TV on bigger screens than we've ever had before. But that is all a very surreal situation. It's not really the reality of what's going on. People need to get off the couch, start talking to their neighbours, start re-engaging in the communities and the societies that they're a part of and take their democracy back, because as I said, democracy does not function. In fact, democracy fails, collapses, ceases to exist unless we're engaged in it. I see that as really the only path forward.
And ironically, it's harder to do demonstrations when the weather's terrible.
Ha.
Well, yes, it is. No one's going to be going out. I mean, it's not all about demonstrations. I mean, they're important, but it's also about the community being creative, taking control of the future.
How are things in terms of SA politics? Because we've seen Jay Weatherill, the Premier, there coming under a lot of heat federally. They've basically tried to do everything they can to make him look incompetent and arguing against the climate strategy that he's brought in, the renewable strategy. What's the mood like domestically? Because I got the sense that he certainly wasn't keen to buckle.
No, and the credit to Jay Weatherill, for having the vision that he's had, particularly on renewables. I think the inroads that they've made there, should be setting a standard for the rest of the country, and they are, which is why they're being attacked. You know, the Achilles heel, obviously, is that his government is also, you know, pushing to expand the, you know, the fossil fuel industry into the Great Australian Bight, up into Central Australia, and unfortunately, the fossil fuel footprint, should those industry expansions take hold, will, you know, blow any renewables, the impact on climate of renewables out of the water, which was the point that I was making before. Renewables should be a no-brainer. That should be seen as something we're just doing, and we should be getting toward 100% renewable power as quickly as we possibly can. But in the meantime, we've got to stop the expansion of this export industry, and we've got to be transitioning out of that fairly quickly.
I mean, one of the things that has been put forward by people who are perhaps somewhat optimistic is that other countries are going to make these decisions for us. I mean, we're already seeing India talking about cutting its coal imports. China has pretty much stopped them altogether. They're rolling that out at the moment. So, you know, things like whether or not Australia wants to keep exporting coal, it does seem like the rest of the world has decided they're not interested in buying it.
Yeah, so that's my point about Australia continuing to invest in yesterday's technology, investing in stranded assets, ultimately doing itself a massive disservice in terms of the strength of our future economy. Like, if we have our wagon clearly hitched to the wrong horse and refuse to acknowledge that and refuse to make the changes required, we're actually bankrupting the future. I mean, that's how serious some of that is. And like I was saying, Andrew, we're living in a very surreal reality here at the moment, in that the level of the discussion around some of this stuff in Australia is just way out of kilter with where it's happening in other parts of the world, partly because the fossil fuel export industry here is so big and so influential.
So pretty much as long as fossil fuel exporters are financially supporting our political parties, it's unlikely that we're going to see any sort of abrupt changes of policy. It seems to be the theme.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big problem. I mean, you also see the movement of staffers through political offices, seeming almost seamlessly, you know, in and out of fossil fuel companies, into key political offices and back out. And I mean, this is just happening non-stop if you're tracking it. And it's quite alarming. The fossil fuel industry obviously has, you know, served a really important purpose if you look back through history. I mean, the lifestyle that we all have now is in part because of the fossil fuel industry. But, you know, so there's no point blaming that. But now in 2017, we understand that we can't continue on this path, because science has developed considerably, and we're seeing some major ramifications climatically. So, you know, again, it shouldn't be a blame thing. It should be a holy moly. We've now discovered this is a very, very bad path to be continuing on, and we need to act responsibly and get off that. You know, that's where the discussion needs to go.
Well, didn't BP make a whole lot of media noise about how they were now beyond petroleum, and yet we aren't beyond petroleum yet? You know, I mean, I know that was clever branding, but, you know, it's sensible.
They did at one point. And part of the problem is government, you know, regulatory frameworks. I'm sure, some of these companies are just businesses. Should the frameworks be right that allow them to move very rapidly into renewable directions, that they probably would. But, you know, governments continue to encourage them to, you know, dig stuff up and ship it out, because that's how governments generate royalties. So, you know, the whole system needs to change in that context. And part of the problem is that exact thing, the demands that governments are putting out there, rather than actually allowing a regulatory process such that it encourages the fast tracking of renewables. And in fact, then you might see a lot of major investment in that direction. And in fact, some of the big fossil fuel companies might start to divest out of their fossil fuels and start to rapidly invest in renewables, because they're clearly going to be the successful companies of the future.
Well, Peter, it sounds like in the end of the day, it is on all of us as voters and as customers of these companies. If we move, they will follow us. So I guess that's what it comes down to in the bottom line, isn't it?
Yes, no doubt. I mean, we ultimately get what we deserve. and if we're just going to sit back and be passive and just whinge about the fact that the future's not going in a sensible direction, well, there's no one really to blame other than ourselves. You know, we need to start making choices along those lines in terms of the types of energy we support, but we also need to engage in the democratic process and start talking to our neighbours and start getting involved in community groups and start, you know, really taking control of the future. I don't see that there's any alternative.
Pete, if we got what we deserved, you and I would both be rock stars now, and Adelaide in 1996 would have been the Seattle of Australia. Like, you know, I think we can agree on that.
That's true. I mean, there's certainly no doubting that. I mean, Adelaide was the Seattle of Australia in the mid 90s. It's just that no one realised it.
Jerks.
with the greatest love possible, guys, not entirely sure your careers as rock stars in the 90s are 100% renewable, but I appreciate the passion. Peter, it's been fascinating. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Cheers, man.
See you, mate. Bye.
Yeah. Another episode coming your way next week, and another live event at Giant Dwarf on the 4th of July. Tickets are on sale now. See ya.